Hello and welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One, because we're the podcast that Formula One deserves, but not the one it needs right now, or something like that. How about working a little Batman reference into Formula One? Hey, Mark, it's Monday night. We're here just to kind of hang out, go over some of the news that has broken over the past couple of days, go over all the massive amounts of emails, and I may, just may, have a Kimi Räikkönen haiku or two to read out during. Of course I do. Kimi's book of haiku. Yeah, well, we'll read out one of those because that ties in nicely to one of the questions in the mailbag. But hey, I don't know what's up with the weather around here. I mean, as people who live in the Pacific Northwest, I mean, I think it's part of our prerogative to complain about the weather, just because our weather sucks most of the time, because we get, I think, about 400 days of rain per year. But I swear to God, I woke up yesterday morning and it was mid-October. I have no idea. It went from spring, skipped over summer, and went straight on into fall. So it's extremely kind of depressing. But how's your day been? How's your week started off? You have that look, that shoot me and put me out of my misery look.
Yeah, getting there. Part of it is just kind of the emotional distaste with this weather we've been having. But I can't complain too much because, you know, I think historically we have generally kind of cool, wet summers in Vancouver. But I think what we experienced in 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18 was we had these like bone dry 4 month summers and we were fighting forest fires and the city was enveloped in smoke. So I guess it's one extreme or the other, but I'd really like to have something in the middle. I look at the forecast, it looks like it's going to be better, which is a good news story. But one thing that kind of helps pull me through this depressing, cloudy, wet, moisture ridden Vancouver weather is the fact that we have a triple header coming up. We have F1 Grand Prix on the next three weekends, which is incredible. And it's funny too, because I posted something on Twitter last night, which is a little bit tongue in cheek, but hey guys, you know what? It's the French Grand Prix, but any Grand Prix is better than no Grand Prix. And one of our listeners quickly hit back and said, hey, well, it might not be the best Grand Prix on the calendar, but we have a really kind of exciting, competitive championship right now, which is something we haven't been able to see for a long time. So regardless of how boring the track might be, it should be an entertaining race just because there's something at stake, which is very, very true.
Yeah, exactly. And you make a great point. It is maybe not the most exciting track based on what we've seen over the past couple of years, but who knows, maybe this is the year that we buck the trend. You know, I'm being a little bit glasses half full on that statement, but yeah, I mean, there's been some moments, but I mean, the one thing that I think we're guaranteed is that the first five or six laps will probably be fairly hectic and eventful based on recent history, but let's hope it turns out to be a little bit more exciting than that. But I mean, we shouldn't diss it too much, because we do still want people to listen to the show on Thursday night, and so we should not maybe throw too much shade at Circuit Paul Ricard too much. Hey, but before we get into things too much, I've got a big list of shout outs that I want to give to our awesome F1 family here. A bunch of you have left reviews on Apple Podcasts recently. You don't need to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts to get a shout out. I mean, you can send us an email or tweet us, but I've been a little bit remiss in not doing this earlier. So first of all, shout outs to Josh Dunlap, John Knus, True88, hashtag WWE Trivia TO, Vintage Viewport, Brian McCarthy, D Chandler 222, JJ Spacely, checking in from the Jetsons? Mr. Spacely's from the Jetsons, right? Hey, I like vintage cartoons. What can I say? Counselor NY, SJRMEY, Simi Sam, I think it is. I can't read my own writing here. Mrs. Sam T and Michael McGivelray. Pardon me. I should be able to do the Irish names at least. Pardon me about that, Michael. Anyways, and also we have a nice email here from Troy in Abbotsford, who's only about half an hour, 45 minutes down the road. Just wanted to check in and say hi. So he's a local listener, been listening for about a month, and just want to let us know that we're not alone here in the Lower Mainland in being Formula One fans. I'm just kind of wondering, though, I mean, for those of you that are local to Vancouver and we're big fans of TSN 1040/Team 1040, could this possibly be a return of Troy and White Rock? Maybe not. But, you know, there were some legendary listeners in the Team 10 40 Days, the Pauser, Troy and White Rock. But
the Pauser goes back to Rock 101 with Dan Russell.
Does it really go back? Does he go back that far? Oh, my gosh. Yeah, all the deserving people that need to go into the BC Sports Hall of Fame.
And just so, okay, now that we've alienated everyone that doesn't live in Vancouver enough.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we'll try to switch up gears here and, you know, pun intended, and get into where do you want to go first? You want to go into the email? I know you've got a pile of tweets that you wanted to talk about. Where do you want to start first? I mean, we could go to JJ in Houston. He wanted to talk about Kimi Räikkönen.
Yeah, let's do H-Town. Let's give Texas some love. I always talk about how much I love Texas. Let's go to
Houston. Yeah. Well, especially because, you know, JJ sent us this email like 2 weeks ago. We've kind of put it off. But this is, I know, you know, JJ's, you know, a real trooper for hanging in there for my procrastination. So apologies from that. Anyways, JJ, this is a long one, but it's really good. So he's Kimi Räikkönen is one of the most interesting athletes in any sport, as far as I'm aware. The Iceman has a world championship and he has little left to prove in, after racing in F1 for close to 20 years. Yet he is still driving currently for a non-dominant team out of his love for the sport. I understand that he brings stability to Alfa Romeo's driver lineup and maintains a diehard fan base despite making historic U.S. President Calvin Silent Cal Coolidge look a dynamic extrovert in comparison. Love that Calvin Coolidge reference, by the way, JJ. My question, in your opinion, do you believe Alfa Romeo's making a good choice for itself by keeping Kimi on their team, or should Alfa Romeo usher a rookie into that F1 via that seat, or is there someone else on the F1 grid currently who might suit Kimi's seats? I have a few other thoughts about Kimi too. I don't think we'll ever see a driver or athlete of any kind again like him. And in day and age where self-expression is among modern society's most prioritized values, i.e. social media is one obvious example, Kimi represents the last of his generation of drivers that did not have to keep up a nonstop barrage of appearances when off the track. The brilliant paradox of Kimi's beloved image in F1 culture is that there is hardly any image at all. Totally agree with that. He is a mysterious figure who only speaks to the few F1 reporters he tolerates during the race, his race engineers on the radio. Though I don't root for him often, my favorite thing about Kimi is seeing how much his fans go bananas for him. Despite being in a sport where he's surrounded by larger-than-life personalities, adoring fans are fascinated by and enamored with the soft-spoken demeanor emanating from his unshading, stone-like visage. Kimi is one of a kind. Still living, listening to and loving the show. Thanks for all the great work that you guys do. Take care, JJ in Houston. So awesome one. You know, just I want to tell you one of like my favorite Kimi anecdotes or stories. And this isn't a new one, but I can't remember what year it was. But it was after the Brazilian Grand Prix. And I think they had Pelé or somebody there to do the podium presentation. And Kimi sort of like appears, I guess, somewhere in the paddock. And I guess the pit lane reporter wanted to get his take on things. Yeah, it was Martin Brundle. Yep. And he asked Kimi, he said, oh, were you here to see Pelé? He said, no, I was in there taking, let's just say he was taking a deuce. And he said it a little bit more colorfully than that. But Kimi, obviously not impressed by, world soccer superstar Pelé presenting the trophies in Brazil that year. But, the thing is, I mean, the way that I tell it is not funny because the way that, you know, if you can sort of picture Kimi saying that and the lack of expression and emotion in his voice and the fact that he's thoroughly unimpressed, it just kind of makes it kind of funny. I mean, sure, look it up on YouTube. I'm sure it's there. Anyways, back to JJ's email. Where do you want to start with that? I mean, I think we've moved on from the Calvin Coolidge reference there. I've got a couple of thoughts on whether or not they should, maybe cut ties with him. But I would think that the obvious choice or maybe the obvious successor is that if they're still doing some sort of development in that team or trying to build a little bit more stability, just like JJ says, I think that Kimi is that guy. But I think the logical successor to that seat would have to be Mick Schumacher. I think just because, you know, he's a Ferrari Academy driver, Haas, Alfa Romeo, all part of the Ferrari family. And, it would be a big step for Mick to go from Haas to Ferrari without some sort of intermediate step, considering he is a very young, very raw talent. And he obviously would need a little bit more time to develop and marinate a little bit in Formula One and soak it up. Because, I mean, he's still really, really young. And the thing is, obviously, they have a very solid driver partnership at Ferrari at the moment with Charles Leclerc and Carlos Sainz, who I think is, you know, I think he's making a strong case to be one of the, I think, the dark horses, maybe one of the unsung hero of the season thus far through the first quarter of the season. But I think for me, that's that would be the natural progression, that the natural replacement for Kimi. And I think the problem is right now is that that if they push Kimi out too soon, who would you replace him with? I mean, Mick, I think it's pretty obvious to say would not be ready to even make that step from Haas to Alfa Romeo. And I think he might need another year at Haas to move up. And then I guess, you know, with the ultimate goal, if it works out that way, to one of these days move him up and put him in one of the fancy, pretty red cars.
Yeah, I like this question because I think the listener, JJ in H-Town, is absolutely right. Kimi is probably one of the most unique personalities on the grid. And to provide some context, this guy's been on the grid for a long time. He entered Formula One in 2001. And I posted, and it's funny because I posted a tweet about this the other day. Just think about what you were doing in 2001. And there you were. And this guy was in Formula One 20 years ago. It's crazy. He's had a tremendous run. He was out of the sport for a couple of years around 2010, 2011. He finished, I think if you flash back, his third full year in the championship with McLaren. He finished second in the championship. He finished second in 2005. Like you said, he won the championship in 07. He finished third in 2008. He left the championship, came back in a bit of a shock move. He joined the recently renamed Renault team, the Lotus team. So Renault had actually left the sport. They continued to produce power units. Obviously, Red Bull were buying them, but as a factory team, they were gone. He came back, and I still think that those Lotus years were some of the most interesting of his career. He was hugely successful with a car that I don't think anyone had any expectations was going to be competitive. He finished third in 2012, his first year back in the championship. He won a race. He had a handful of podiums. And to put it into context too, just because I think it's really good for our listeners, he has now raced in 340 Grand Prix. He has 103 podiums. So he scored a podium in almost a third of all of his races. And he has 21 race wins. He's a terrific racer. He loves Formula One. He loves the competitive nature of the sport. To your point too, it's kind of interesting. And I've never been able to kind of reconcile myself to his personality, because that term you used, Iceman, it really comes from the fact that he is so, I don't know if I want to say abrasive. I can say abrasive. Like, he's abrasive with the media. He's short with the media. He's very economical with the words that he uses. And if he can respond to a long, convoluted question from an F1 journalist in a single word, he will. Yeah. And he gets away with it because he's the Iceman and because he has a world championship. So be it. I think some of the stories about him are hilarious. And I wasn't sure which story you were going to share, but there's another story.
There's plenty of them.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I was reading another one today. Did you know, allegedly, and this is based on a biography that I haven't read in full, but in 2008, he was arrested in Singapore because he thought it would be funny to climb into the baggage scanner at the airport and get a body scan through the X-ray machine. Once drunk for 16 consecutive days between Grand Prix during a championship. This is a guy who showed up for the FIA awards show at the end of 2018, completely drunk on stage. Like, he's got a bit of a, I don't give a F attitude, which is kind of cool. Now, to answer JJ's question, one, he made this comment and I wrote it down here because I don't necessarily agree with it. And maybe it's true, but he made that comment that, hey, he's racing for the love of the sport. Well, he's racing for the love of the sport, but also because Alfa Romeo is paying him $10 million a year. And it's also generally understood that that money's coming from Ferrari. Ultimately, he's valuable to Alfa Romeo, not necessarily because of what he can do on the track, but what he can do for that team from a sponsorship perspective. And I've talked about this so many times. One of the core channels of revenue for these teams is sponsorship, the decals that go on the side of the car. And it's so much easier to go and knock on the door of Mr. Corporation and ask for dollars if you can sell them on a picture of Kimi Raikkonen standing next to a car with your logo on it. It makes it easier. So oftentimes, teams will hold on to older world champions because of that. Now, that said, I totally agree with you in that it should ultimately be Mick Schumacher who's in that team. I worry about how dysfunctional and broken the Haas team might be financially, organizationally, structurally. I worry about his development there. I'm probably a little less concerned than you are about getting him to Alfa Romeo because I don't think it's that significant of a jump. But ultimately, I think for me, I would be more interested in questioning the role of Antonio Giovinazzi on that team. Again, he's improved and he seems to be a capable driver. Great guy. He's done some great sim work, great test driver, and things like that.
Yeah.
But maybe a team with MSC and Kimi Raikkonen. But then again, part of it too is I think sometimes it's valuable to have an older, more experienced driver on a team with a younger driver because they can share data, they can share telemetry. I don't know how collaborative Kimi would be with a younger driver or if he would be collaborative at all. But I do agree that at some point, you got to move on. But I think as long as he adds value to that team in terms of sponsorship and revenues, he's probably not going anywhere. And I don't think there's a whole lot of pressure on Alfa Romeo to make that Michael Schumacher or Mick Schumacher switch yet.
Yeah.
I think I answered the question.
I think so. Hey, before we wrap this one up and we go into our first break here, I'm just going to read here from Kimi's book of haiku. And this one is called Normal. If we all feel normal, then all of my friends are also not normal. There you go. Haikus allegedly written by Kimi. It's a funny book. I mean, you got to take it with a bit of a pinch of salt. Anyways, time for a break. When we come back, we're going to go to your tweets and we'll do so in just a moment. So don't go away. We will be right back.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time, or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Okay, well, welcome back to the show, Mark. Over to you now. You're the controller, the master and commander of the Twitters. I know you've got a whole bunch here. And again, guys, thank you for all the questions. Thank you for all the tweets. We don't really have enough time to read them all. We could literally do a show like this each and every night of the week. So I know that you picked out a couple that really stood out that you wanted to. Like, I mean, you've been dying to talk about some of them, and I know you're itching to get go. So where are we going now? What's the next topic on the agenda, Mark?
So I'm going to share a couple that we're not going to get to. So this is going to sound super cool. At Ben Hunter had a fantastic question this morning about the fact that Ferrari looks to be changing up their engine formula for next season. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great question. Something we'll probably hit on an upcoming show because I want a little bit more time to research that and get a sense of what's happening at the factory because it's not super clear yet. Zachary has a great question about what the nature of having back-to-back races at the Red Bull Ring will look like. I think we'll talk about that one as we get a little bit closer to that race. And there's a couple of other really good questions here, but the one I want to dig into, and this is, and honestly, it's almost embarrassing that you and I haven't talked about this, but Michael Boverhoff had, and I am just known now for butchering people's names. So please DM me and clean me up for this. But he made a great question about the fact that, hey, look, Mercedes aren't rocking their DAS system this year. Is this having any impact on their performance? And I'll be very honest. We've reached out to Tim Haraney, who is the analyst for TSN up here in Canada. He's a former race car driver. He does a whole bunch of promotional work with F1. He has relationships with all the drivers, blah, blah, blah. So I basically posed the question to him. It's like, from your perspective, given the fact that you've raced open wheel race cars at the highest imaginable levels, is this having an impact? And on what part of the race? Like, is this an issue in the straights? Is this a detriment in the corners? His answer was basically, yes, it's having an impact, and it's having an impact everywhere on the track. So to back this up a little bit, back at the beginning of 2020, so during winter testing, Mercedes were out in winter testing, rocking their new car, the W11, and some kind of eagle-eyed viewers had noticed something from the in-car footage that was being shown on TV. And what was being shown on TV is that Valtteri and Lewis would be in the car with the steering wheel in their hands, and at certain moments, they would pull that steering wheel towards them, almost like they were pulling it off the rack. And people freaked out because they didn't know what was happening. And what Mercedes had developed during the offseason is something that they were calling the dual axis steering system, the DAS system. And what it enabled them to do was adjust the toe of the front tires. Now, to give a little bit of context, all cars have some degree of toe. So toe is basically a reference or the measurement of the direction of the tires when they're mounted on the front of the car and the steering wheel is straight. So if you have 0 degree toe and your steering wheel is pointed forward, the two front wheels are pointed directly forward. And that's conventional for a road car. It's good because you get even wear on the tire, because if your toe is off, for instance, let's say you hit a pothole really bad and one of the toe gets thrown out on the right tire, you're going to get uneven wear, the tire's going to tug a little bit. So ultimately in a road car, those two front tires should be pointed straight forward. Now in Formula One over the years, the engineers have discovered that it actually is a little bit helpful to have a little bit of negative toe on those front tires. So they're actually splayed out a little bit. So it's very, very difficult to notice. But what engineers have discovered is that, hey, look, if we put a little bit of negative toe on those tires, so your left front tire and your right front tire actually point outwards a little bit, so it looks odd from the top down, it actually provides some benefits in cornering. Now, the negative side of that is you get uneven wear. The tire doesn't warm evenly across the entire compound and those kind of pieces. You get uneven tire degradation, but ultimately all of these things are worthwhile because you get this better cornering ability. Now, what Mercedes had designed was a system that when you're driving straight and they pulled that steering wheel towards you, those two front tires went from a negative toe to a 0 degree toe. So they actually straighten themselves out. So in a straight line, that's really beneficial because you get less drag, you get less tire degradation, you get even tire degradation, and the tires warm more uniformly. So when you do hit a corner, you're going to get better grip. So everyone in the sport freaked out. Red Bull at the very first race protested this, and they were all protesting this based on the premise that this was a suspension change. So Formula One is incredibly strict about suspension. They are all about static suspensions. You cannot have electronic dampening. You cannot have driver controllable suspension. You cannot not have an airbag. You can have nothing. It's got to be a purely static suspension. So Red Bull and all these teams were protesting based on the premise that, wait a minute, that is a driver aid for the suspension. The FIA came back and they're like, actually, you know what? Based on our technical observations, this is a steering enhancement, which isn't prohibited by the rule books. Now, it became known very, very quickly that it was going to be prohibited for 2021. So it was kind of a one year kind of show, but it was presumably quite beneficial. So this year, Mercedes had to come back without the benefit of this DAS steering system. And it's not clear what it was adding to the car in terms of lap time. Is it a tenth of a second, 0.2 seconds, where it was really beneficial? We know it made the cars faster in the straight. We know that because the tire degradation was less, cornering ability should have been better. We know that because the tires were warming uniformly, you probably should have had better grip most of the corners, like blah, 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 blah. But ultimately, they don't have this system this year. That's the point. So the question was, is this having an impact on Mercedes? And the answer is probably, yeah, because ultimately they weren't able to substitute this with a different system. So they had this really cool driver aid in a sense last year. That's maybe not a driver aid, but this mechanical aid last year, and it's gone. So there's no doubt that this is having some impact on the performance of the car, especially when you index it against the fact that Red Bull comes back with such a powerful package. And again, this isn't just me speaking. Like I said, I went to Tim Haraney, the TSN analyst up here in Canada, and he specifically said, absolutely, it is certainly having an impact on the car in all aspects of their performance. Straight line, because they've got more drag, because the wheels are splayed out. It's having more impact in the corners because they have less mechanical grip, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, great question. And hopefully that helps provide a little bit of context for everyone in terms of what DAS did last year for Mercedes.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, when that first came out, really caught everybody by surprise way back pre-pandemic. I mean, it's hard to kind of remember back to those days. But the first thing that really kind of struck me about it was just the whole, you know, we could see the two drivers pulling and pushing on the steering wheel. But the immediate comparison I drew was back to the early mid-90s with the active suspension that Williams had developed for the FW14B. Now, just in real brief, this was like an automatic suspension system that they had that basically would adjust the, take into effect what was happening to the car on the track and just set that optimal ride heights and clearance off of the road. I mean, it was ultimately banned because I think one of the concerns was that there was a really huge increase in the speed as these cars went through the corners. But that was actually, there was something that was... It wasn't new. It was something that was actually pioneered by Lotus back in the mid-1980s, and they did some work with it, but it was Williams that picked it up and ran with it. And the days when Williams were the Mercedes of Formula One, they weren't as dominant, but they were one of the best teams in the 80s and 90s. So that was my initial reaction to it. But it's interesting too, the whole DAS system, and maybe it's just because it was made known pretty quick that it wouldn't be permitted in 2021, but it was just the fact that it was so avant-garde and nobody else thought to do it besides Mercedes. And then I guess maybe it's just because that it got banned for 2021 so quickly was the fact that nobody else tried to copy it. It was just like, okay, this thing's only going to be around for a little while, so why should we sink all this time and money and effort into something that we're just going to develop for, 8 or 10 races or however long it is that that we're going to be able to run this thing. But interesting.
And the only thing I'll add to that as well is this has historically been the benefit of being a team like Mercedes. Like, let's not kid ourselves. A system like that would have cost tens of millions of dollars to develop and test in total secrecy. And this is just one of those innovations that actually makes it to the car. Like, think about all the things that they develop and test that we never even hear about because maybe they don't add the advantage. Maybe they're too clearly a violation of the technical regulations, blah, 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 blah. But this is one of those things that will eventually be, we will see less of this innovation, partly because of the cost cap. And I think we're already starting to see this, but also because the formula and the technical regulations are going to be so much tighter, teams and engineers just won't have the creative license to develop technical innovations like this because they're going to try and kind of parse down that level of it while you can, because this type of innovation is going to be less common. And maybe that's okay because if the racing's better and we have racing in Formula One like we did last weekend in Indy, shout out to Kevin Magnussen for the race win on Saturday, unbelievable, then all the better for the sport.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, the one thing that I think that we need to give a bit of a shout out is to Mercedes operational security. I mean, talk about being airtight. I mean, this caught everybody by surprise when it was first, it came to everybody's attention back in Barcelona in 2020. I mean, that is phenomenal that not a whiff of this leaked out of Mercedes. I mean, that is, phenomenal. I mean, talk about keeping things tightly under wraps. I mean, that was impressive.
Totally. And I think one of the things that a lot of our North American viewers are really surprised by is when they see the drivers in Parc Fermé or they see the drivers walking past the car of another team, they always peek in the cockpit. They'll look under the side. They'll look at the back. They have photographers positioned all around the track during winter testing because what the other teams are bringing are often a total surprise. And they want to know as early as possible, like what innovations, what are they doing with their floor, their barge boards, their side pods? What does their exhaust look like? Their rear diffuser, their rear wing, because they've had this creative license to get really innovative in those spaces. So teams are really secretive. And I think you and I have talked about this in the past that historically in winter testing, when the cars weren't on the track, they would bring them into the garage, the pit garage, and they put up huge screens. So the other teams and the cameras couldn't see what was happening in the garage. And Formula One's done away with that now. They're like, no. We want people on TV to see what's happening. But yeah, it speaks to the secrecy of the sport. But totally, kudos to Mercedes for keeping something like that under wraps.
Yeah, absolutely. And just Falco Fire weighing in on the live chat on YouTube. And the comment or the question is F1 a continuous cat and mouse game of rule breaking and regulation?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I mean,
that's why we all love it.
Yeah.
That's why we absolutely love it.
Yeah, it could be because they... are constantly trying to see what they can get away with and trying to bend the rules and regulations 100% to their own their advantage. All right, awesome question. What's up for next?
Just a quick question that I noticed that just hit up in our feed as well, because this is actually a question we get all the time. And
sure.
And it's funny, man, because I think we probably addressed, and I'm cool to address it 1,000 times, but
sure.
The question of F1 apparel. So Tasimba in the live chat asks, random questions. Why is F1 apparel so expensive compared to other sports?
Shocking.
At the moment, I have to decide between a jacket for me and the missus or a PlayStation 5.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty stark, comparison right there. It's just like, do I need some F1 merch or do I need a PS5? I mean, if you can get your hands on one, of course, but, yeah, it's just absolutely shocking how much the F1 stuff is. I mean, it's basically, my collection is basically limited to hats, and they're expensive enough. I mean, great question.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't think either of us had the answer. We're going to do a really great show during the summer break, and we're going to talk a lot about F1 merchandise and F1 sponsorship and F1 branding with Mr. Landino, which I think we'll probably tease a little bit more coming up. But I think it ultimately just comes down to the fact that teams manage their apparel independently of F1. So typically, if you look at North American sports, whether it's the NFL or Major League Baseball or the NBA, the league negotiates apparel deals independent of the actual teams. So the league will negotiate independently of the teams with Nike or Majestic, or historically Majestic, Major League Baseball, now Nike as well. But they'll negotiate on behalf of the teams, and they'll strike an apparel deal with all these different providers collaboratively. In F1, the teams manage the apparel themselves. So they find their own suppliers, they find their own sponsors. So some teams might have Puma or Umbro, or in the past, a Hugo Boss, or whatever the case may be. So they have complete license to do whatever they want, which also means they get to price it however they want. Mm-hmm. You see these real price discrepancies. And I think it just comes down to the fact that, unfortunately, they can charge that much because they're selling it. If they weren't selling it, they would charge less. That said, in my experience, some of the stuff that I bought has been, from a quality perspective, really good. Like, I bought a black Mercedes t-shirt in 2016. It still looks brand new. It's heavy cotton. It looks fantastic. It wears fantastic. So some of the stuff is good, but it's still really tough to swallow $60 or $80. But then again, I'm saying that, and I've spent $300 on an authentic NBA jersey. So who am I to talk
to? Good point. Hey, let's take another quick break here, Mark. And when we come back, we'll go to the next one. I'm going to save you guys. I'm only going to do one Kimi haiku unless I get some sort of feedback here on the live chat if we want more of Kimi's book of haiku here. But anyways, time for quick break. Hang in there. We'll be back in just a moment. So please don't go away.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
5-1-0, declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And Mark, are you teasing with your helmet or or is that, you're just teasing, aren't you? What's up next?
It's a studio prop. Another great question. So this is one, and I can't even attribute this to one person because I've had so many people asking us to talk a lot about the W Series and more about the role in the future of women in motorsport. And this is something that we're looking to tee up as a dedicated show during the off season, because we really want to deep dive into this topic. But excitingly, there was some news recently about the W Series. And to kind of back this up a little bit, if you look at the world of motorsports, there have been some women that have had success. And you know, we can talk about Danica Patrick and some of her successes in NASCAR. She won an IndyCar race in Japan back in, I think, 2008. I was lucky enough, I've seen her drive in person. I haven't met her, but I've seen her race in person. So there have been some women that have been successful in motorsport. But ultimately, the challenge for women in this motorsport historically is that at the grassroots level, we haven't done enough as a society to encourage or incent young girls to participate. It's a boy-dominated sport. If you go to your local karting track on any given weekend, of 100 karters on the track, maybe two or three of them are going to be girls. So no matter how talented they may be, there's just not enough of them to overcome the odds and break through at the open wheel level, whether it's Formula 2, Formula 1, IndyCar. There's just not enough of them competing. So ultimately, we as a society and what the FIA and all of these grassroots organizations need to do is do more to encourage young girls to get involved in karting, because I think once they do, it's a really good sport for them to be able to compete at. Now, a couple of years ago, as a tool to help promote women in motorsports, a couple of folks, not least of which were David Coulthard and Adrian Newey and a few other people, got together and they helped stand up the W Series. So the W Series raced its first and to date its only championship in 2019. So it was a 20-driver, 10-team, well, I guess you couldn't even say they had 10 teams, but 20-driver, 6-race championship. And it was ultimately won by Brit Jamie Chadwick. There was some interesting racing. They raced a non-championship reverse grid race as well, which was actually won by a Canadian racer, which was really cool to see. But ultimately, it kind of raced independently of any other championship. So exposure was a little bit low. They weren't getting a lot of love from the major networks. They didn't race last year because of the COVID pandemic, but they are going to race this year. And there's two really key developments that are going to help the W Series. One is the fact that it's now paired up with Formula One. So the W Series won't be racing independently of Formula One or any other championship. So in the previous, it would go off to Assen, it would go off to these other tracks, and it would race by itself. Mm-hmm. It's really difficult to get the media or a television network to follow an unestablished championship, to go to a track and set up the cameras, invest the money, not knowing if anyone's going to watch. Now, the benefit now is you will be seeing the W Series race on the same weekend at the same track as Formula One. So it just becomes part of the spectacle, which is great news because all of the F1 media is there. You're going to have 100,000 people throughout the race weekend, maybe 200,000 or 300,000, depending on the race. You're also going to have the networks there. So the benefit is by racing at an F1 event on an F1 weekend as a support series, you have a built-in audience. So what we saw this last week was the announcement that a whole slew of new networks have signed up to start broadcasting W Series. It's not clear where it's going to be broadcast in Canada, but it's great for the sport. In 2021, you're going to see 8 events in the W Series Championship. I've got them right here. You're going to see a doubleheader at the Red Bull Ring. They're going to race at Silverstone, the Hungora Ring. They're going to be at Spa, Zandvoort, Circuit of the Americas, and they're going to be in Mexico City as well. So you're going to get some geographical representation. Now, I think the one thing that I really want to preface is that there's some incredibly talented women racing in that series. Whether any of them will eventually make the leap to Formula One or make the leap to Formula Two or Formula Three to continue their trajectory towards Formula One, I don't know. I am very, very, very confident that with some of the changes that the FIA is doing to help encourage and incent young girls to get into motorsport, and I think with some of the things that individual national programs are doing, national bodies are doing to incent this, we'll eventually see female representation of Formula One. And maybe not in 5 years, but I'm very confident we'll see it in 10 years. And, you know, we've been talking about the fact that there's some talented young girls or talented young women racing now in F4. I think we've tweeted a couple times, Hamda Al-Khabisi, the Emirati racer, is doing really well. She scored a podium in F4 Italian Championship a week and a half ago, which was really cool to see. She's an up-and-coming talent, and there are countless others. It's just going to take a little bit of time. And the disadvantage that women have is that they haven't had the same opportunity at that young level that boys historically have. And hopefully with the W Series promoting motorsports, it'll help incent and encourage young girls to get involved. So hopefully that answers all of the questions that our listeners have had about the W Series and women in motorsports.
You know, it really is interesting because I think Sebastian Vettel was just even saying this week in the last couple of days just how cost prohibitive racing in the junior series are, regardless, I think, you know, race, gender, just anything in general. I mean, we've talked about it on the show before. I mean, if you look at the Formula One grid, I mean, there's a pretty obvious pattern of the kind of people that are racing in Formula One and what their background is. I think that's why Lewis is, you know, why he stands out. I mean, you know, he's such the, you know, I don't want to say he's the odd man out in a bad way, because he's not, but I mean, he just doesn't fit that sort of stereotype, obviously, right? I mean, he comes from a working class family. I mean, he's black. I mean, he doesn't come from a privileged background. And I mean, they worked very hard to, you know, to get where he is and get those opportunities. And but I mean, he is the rare case. And that's the one thing that Formula One is supposed to be. It's supposed to be the 20 best drivers in the world. You know, asterisk, right? I mean, and so this is, I think what we've talked about before with the whole We Race is One thing, which I don't want to go as far as say that we're skeptical about. I mean, I think there definitely is a degree of skepticism, but I think it's more like, okay, well, yeah, I guess it is skepticism. But I'm going to say it's that if we're sitting here and say, okay, well, this is what you guys are saying. Now prove it. We want more racial diversity in motorsports. Okay, that's a start. And Lewis is going doing his own thing as well. But then, you know, it has to be all inclusive, right? And I mean, that's the one thing, that if it's just going to be all male drivers, then that's one thing. But then I guess you couldn't really make that claim to be, you know, the 20 best drivers in the world, because, you know, you're only, you know, focusing on one specific, you know, part of the human, you know, demographics and population, right? So who knows? I mean, it'd be great. I mean, the one thing is that regardless drivers of race or gender, whatever it might be, it's just getting those opportunities. And obviously some people are just not getting those opportunities in general. And then of course, if it's cost prohibitive, then it's just difficult no matter who you are. And then cases and people like Lewis Hamilton that you know, worked hard to come up through the junior series just may never get those opportunities. And I think that in the long run, it's a loss for the sport, right? Because these bright talents, so, you know, wherever they're coming from whatever corner of the globe, just are never going to get that opportunity to shine on the big stage. And I think that that we in general, you know, we're worse off for it. I think that that we're missing out.
I worry a little bit too about the impact that this concept of the straight up pay driver has on the American audience, and ultimately Formula One can exist and it can be successful without the United States, but obviously that's not beneficial long term. You want to be successful in the United States, you want to have an audience there. But I think one of the things that I think our listeners really struggle with, and a lot of my friends really struggle with, is this concept of the pay driver. And so many people have reached out to me to talk about Mazepan, and they're like, so and they'll ask me point blank, they're like, let me get this straight. And Mazepan, but doesn't have a seat. Mm-hmm. They're like, Nick DeVries won an F2 championship, has never had a sniff of Formula One. Magnussen's out. Grosjean's out. Hulkenberg doesn't have a seat. Like, they just go down this list, and it's like, you know what? At the end of the day, it's exactly what you think it is. He's effectively a pay driver, and his dad bought him the seat. And that's the unfortunate reality of Formula One, is that you have some drivers that are there purely on talent. And you mentioned one, Lewis. I think Daniel Ricciardo is another perfect example of that. But you also have a lot of drivers that had certain advantages, financial advantages, because it's a super expensive sport. And that would be the Mazepans of the world. And I think sometimes drivers are forgiven a little bit. Obviously, Max had some advantages that other drivers didn't. He grew up around the sport. He had access to technology, academies that other drivers wouldn't. He's not an organic product that grew up in the suburb of Amsterdam or Paris and just happened to like Formula One. He had some advantages. And
Lance is another guy. Yeah,
totally. And again, we love them both. And I think Lance has proven that he can be successful at the highest level, which is great. But they're also compelling characters, and they're great personalities, and they represent Canada well. But I think that's a real question, which is, we don't see that in NASCAR, and we don't see, well, maybe sometimes with sponsors, but we don't see that in the NBA or the Premier League or Major League Baseball. Like, you have to be there of your own physical merits. And in Formula One, it's a little bit shady. Actually, not shady, gray.
Yeah, it's a bit of a gray area. I know. I mean, as somebody that's watched Formula One for, you know, ever since I was a kid, I mean, the concept of a pay driver is not new to me either. And it is something that I still don't completely wrap my head around, especially when you just ran off that list there of guys that currently aren't in Formula One and clearly are talented enough to be, but they don't necessarily come with a big fat sponsorship deal or, you know, a big pile of money with them. And, yeah, it's frustrating. So, I mean, it is obviously at a very tough and elite sport to get into. And you know, I guess circle back to the whole We Race is One thing. But at the end of the day, I mean, that's the whole part of the conversation that currently the way that it is now, there is only 20 seats available, and they should be open to the 20 best drivers in the world. And I guess it's just opening that pool up to actually make it all inclusive to actually get all 20 best drivers in the world into the series. So yeah.
Do we have time for a related question? Because I would love your thoughts on this.
Sure. Yeah. We're going to go into a break in about 3 minutes. So, if you can squeeze it in, go for it.
Yeah. So this is a great question and I just kind of teed this one up because I thought of it while we were talking, but a great question from Benoit Plamondon. He asked a question. He's like, another fact that I find interesting is the desire of Haas to find an American pilot. Gunter Steiner is often questioned about it and does not hide that he would like to have an American pilot, but that currently there is none. No American currently has the super license required to compete at Formula One level. What are your thoughts just on that question and Haas and their commitment to an American driver, et cetera?
Well, it is really interesting. And, I think this there was an email that I received from somebody about a week or two ago, basically asking this very same question. And, I think it's like anything else. I think that, I don't think it comes to any surprise to, that once, Americans get their, set their eyes or their sights on something they want to be successful at, they'll make it happen, right? So if they want to get a successful American driver into Formula One, it's going to happen. And let's not forget, Americans have been successful in Formula One. Americans have won world championships in Formula One. It's just been a really, really long time since an American actually won a Grand Prix. We're probably going back to Mario Andretti in what, the late 1970s? Let's not forget that Phil Hill won the world championship for Ferrari in what, 1961, 1962? Mario, an extremely successful driver in Formula One with Lotus. His son Michael raced in for McLaren in the 1990s. Eddie Cheever raced in Formula One in the 80s for a long, long time. But it's overdue to have an American driver in Formula One. And the original question was posed to me by Devin Rance, who was basically asking the same thing. And he wants to know, do all the good American drivers go to Indy or NASCAR? I think there's obviously that's part of it. But then again, there is, is that funnel of a development, there for them? Sergio Perez, a Mexican driver, he said he basically had to give up his childhood to go and race in Europe because that's where all the feeder series were and all the opportunities to get noticed and hopefully get into a situation that would lead into Formula One. And, and I think that's the same thing right now with American drivers. Are there guys in the USA that are talented enough to race in Formula One? Absolutely. Are they getting the opportunities that they need? No, they're not getting them for one reason or another. Obviously Lance has got that opportunity, which has probably obviously been brokered by his dad's money and contacts and opportunities. He's got the talent. It's just that his dad's connections and money has helped, open doors along the way. And the same with Nick as Nicholas as well. And I'm not going to look down at them at all. They've had to work hard. It's not like here's a fast car, go out there. We see the dark side to that in what's going on the other side of the Haas garage next to Mick Schumacher and how much struggles the other driver there is having, right? So it it doesn't work out all the time, but that's the thing. I'm sure that there are American drivers out there. They're just not getting their opportunities.
I'll try and answer this quickly as well, because I know we have to get to a break. But to your point, the last American to win a championship was, let me double check here, Mario Andretti in 1978. And the last American to win a Grand Prix was Mario Andretti at the Dutch Grand Prix in 1978. So you're right. It's been a while.
Gosh.
When I answered this question for Benoit, I think it just comes down to desire. Like young American carters, kids that are racing in karts at 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, they're racing on dirt ovals, ovals, short tracks, super speedways. They grow up and they see NASCAR. And they see Indy. In NASCAR, there are hundreds of opportunities to race in the various NASCAR sanctioned series. Hundreds of opportunities.
Yeah.
So you grow up racing karts and you're racing on ovals. there's a clear pathway and you don't have to leave the United States. And likewise with Indy as well, you know, you can drive carts and you can get comfortable with ovals and short ovals and speedways and kind of graduate into Indy and you don't have to leave the United States. Your point about Sergio Perez is bang on. If you want to be successful in Formula One, there is no development feeder series in the United States. Motorsports in the U.S., and justifiably so, is structured to feed the domestic racing series, all of the different NASCAR sanctioned series in IndyCar. Ultimately, if you want to be successful in Formula One, you've got to go to Asia or you've got to go to Europe. And for a lot of young American drivers, why would I do that? Yeah. I'm going to go to Europe when I'm 12 years old. I'm going to live away from home in a country where I don't speak the language to have a shot at one in 20 seats. F that, I will stay at home and have a shot at one of 100 different stock car seats. So
yeah,
I think it's different. And Lance and Nicholas are slightly different because I think their aspirations from a very young age were always Formula One. They're Canadian drivers. They were exposed to Formula One in a different way. They were exposed to motorsports in a different way. And their entire career is built around it. They're both shipped off to Europe when they're in their teens or their late tweens. They got a taste of Formula and the championship and the drivers and the culture at a young age. But for American drivers, what's the incentive? Go to Europe, spend $1 million a year and ultimately not have a shot at one of the 20 seats anyways. I'll stay at home and I'll compete for a spot in sanctioned stock car.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing is too, you could be the one American guy that makes into Formula One that nobody's ever heard of at home, right?
Exactly,
you know, whereas you could be racing at Daytona or you could be racing at Indy and you could be a household name in racing or in families and people that are race fans, right? Totally. So, I mean, you can sacrifice all that and be a virtual nobody. I mean, it might change now. I mean, we're seeing obviously a lot of interest over the last couple of years. I mean, is there somebody in the pipeline right now? I mean, we've talked about Colton Herta, and I mean, he was Mario's pick that for a guy he'd like to see in Formula One. Or is there somebody a little bit younger that's in maybe one of these feeder series? And heaven forbid that there's somebody that hasn't even, that is not yet even born, that might be the great white hope to make it into Formula One.
I just want to add one thing, because I know we got to go to a break. Shame on Haas. You know what? And I'll be very, very strict here. They've been in the championship since 2015. They could have started an academy. They could have identified young drivers. They could have pumped money into the U.S. system. They could have brought talent over from the United States and paid for their boarding and their development in the U.S. Haas has done nothing to develop a pipeline of U.S. talent. So, you know what? Gunther Steiner can say whatever he wants. Gene Haas and that team have done nothing to nurture a young talent. They've been in the championship for 6 years. They could have developed somebody that was 12 or 13 or 5 or 10 of them, and they could have had somebody that was ready from the U.S. for this car. Now, they've had the time, and shame on them because they've done nothing to develop and nurture a U.S. talent. Okay,
yeah,
break.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, you're getting good at this. Anyways, as Mark said, we're going to take a break. Don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. All right. Well, I'm just going to sit back now. I mean, you can, you're all good to go. You can have the controls now, but anyways, welcome back to the show, everybody. Okay. Well, we were, that was a little bit of an interesting tangent to talk about just before the break there. Anyways, where do you want to go to now? What's next up in the next topic for us?
So here's a really good question. And I like this one. So this one comes from at Broncos Elite. He asked this question. This isn't necessarily a podcast question, although I should have said that. Here's a great podcast question, is what he quote unquote said. But why are all of the fans in orange? And what he's alluding to here are Verstappen fans. He's like, are they Verstappen fans or are they just Red Bull fans in general? I'm going to toss this question over to you because I think from a genetic DNA level, you might be more equipped to answer this question.
Yeah, well, you know, it would have been nice if you kind of given me a heads up for this one, because I could have actually come prepared and worn the appropriate attire for that. So anyways, that goes to the House of Orange and the colors that of the Dutch royal family and Holland and all that. So basically, in when it comes to the Star Spangled Banner, red, white and blue, I mean, you know, think about 4th of July and everything that you would dress up and wear on those you know, for celebrations like that, obviously, right? So, I mean, that is the colors that that represent the Dutch national teams. And I mean, you go, I mean, the Euro 2020 competition is on for European soccer right now. And me being half Dutch, and well, I'm half Dutch, half English, which makes me 100% Canadian. But I mean, the Dutch side of my background, I identify heavily with. I mean, I lived there for most of my 20s. I'm fluent in the language. I mean, I feel as at home there as I do here in Canada. And they're very, very passionate. I mean, when I first went to my first Formula One race back in 2001, I did see Verstappen race. Now, that was Jos the Boss. And Max was just, you know, knee high to a grasshopper at that point. But I mean, Jos was popular. But I mean, he was also racing for TWR Arrows, which was, you know, basically your Williams, Haas, back of the grid team. And I mean, he did what he could. I mean, he did have a stint at Benetton as well in the mid 1990s. But I mean, he just, and I mean, he, you know, kudos to him. I'm going to give him, you know, credit here, because when he was asked, just when Max was breaking into Formula One, who was the faster driver, and Jos straight up said that it was Max. So Max is obviously, you know, he's a legit Formula One driver. He's got all the credentials now that he's matured a little bit, and all the attributes to be a world champion, given that, you know, given the opportunity to compete for one in a competitive car, which this year looks more, you know, possible than in the past several years. But that's the thing. I mean, he's developed a bit of a cult following, and that's the thing, especially when it comes to races. Obviously, we're going to go to Zandvoort, which is in Holland this year. That's going to be a sea of orange, but you're also going to see it in a lot of the European races as well. I mean, Red Bull Ring. I mean, a couple of years ago, it looked like a World Cup soccer match with the you know, the the amount of Dutch fans that traveled there. Belgium's going to be the same, and then you're going to see pockets of them at different races as well. I mean, Dutch people love to travel. I mean, everywhere that you go, you're always going to run into Dutch people. I mean, for better or worse. And I mean, of course, I'm going to say for better, but you're going to see pockets of Max fans all the time. And you know, if you want to see what I'm talking about, maybe this year's a bit of a bad of an example, because we're living this post-pandemic world right now. So if you go and watch you know, soccer match at Euro 2020, the stadiums aren't quite full. But I mean, go back, watch you know, replays from World Cups and Euros past, and you'll see what I'm talking about. And that sort of mentality, and the way that they're very passionate, especially about their soccer teams, that passion has really you know, transferred over, and they've really adopted Max. And he's like I say, he's a bit of a cult hero in Holland now. And you know, it's funny, because you know, I see Max in certain ways. And you know, we were talking earlier, you know, about Kimi, you know, with from JJ's email off the top of the show, about this sort of standoffish, kind of gritty kind of guy. Max is sort of kind of that way, but I know for some people he kind of rubs them the wrong way. But culturally, I get it. Because I mean, I understand him, because I recognize that characteristic and that personality, not so much in myself, but it's definitely a lot of traits I think that that Max has is very, very Dutch. And I think that that he's very identifiable to Dutch people, and he's fast as heck, and he wins races, and you know, he's not afraid to speak his mind. And I think that's what makes him, you know, pretty genuine and very, you know, likable from like a Dutch point of view. So you know, I'm going to let you take it. I'm going to run upstairs and get an orange t-shirt and come back. And
yeah, go. You've got time. I'll blather on for 20 minutes.
There you go.
I think what you were referring to, and what the listener was referring to, is historically in a conventional F1 season, yeah, when you see the shots of the grandstands, you'll see entire grandstands that are just blanketed in orange. And you're right. That's intentional. And it's very similar to MotoGP. And I keep talking about MotoGP, but in MotoGP, when you buy your tickets to an event, you actually get to buy your tickets based on the grandstand of the rider that you support. So you can buy tickets to sit in the Valentino Rossi grandstand or the Marc Marquez grandstand. And when you go in there, they provide your shirt, their banners, and you are there. You are a sea of fluorescent yellow. You are a sea of orange or whatever the case may be. But the really cool thing is Max has kind of brought a little bit of that flavor, and the Dutch fans have brought that passion to Formula One, which is really cool. It's just, it's so unfortunate that we weren't able to capture any of that last year or really early this year. But I promise as the season goes on for our newer listeners, this is something that makes the races that much more exciting. It looks like the Red Bull Ring has found a way to ensure that we'll see a capacity crowd for both of those races upcoming in Austria. And you should absolutely see that sea of orange that that you were referring to.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting too. I mean, just with different drivers at different times in Formula One. I mean, like I said, when I went to my first race back in 2001 was right sort of getting to sort of peak Schumacher. I mean, he'd already won a couple of titles. He was a Ferrari, was really, really competitive at that point. The Nürburgring was absolutely blanketed from one end to the other in Ferrari scarlet red. And I mean, Michael being a German driver, I mean, you know, they chose to adopt the team colors rather than say, like German colors. I mean, for their soccer team is, white shirts with black shorts, for example. But I mean, the orange is very, very identifiable. And I think it just really depends where the driver's from, which team he's racing with, and how his fans tend to identify with that specific driver. But it's a great question.
And one of the things that I think Lance and Nicholas were really disappointed about is that for the second consecutive year, we weren't able to have a Grand Prix in Canada where we had two drivers. And I think a lot of people were excited to see what the crowd would have looked like and how much the two of them. And of course, Lance has raced in Canada before during a Grand Prix weekend, but Nicholas hasn't had that opportunity. Cool.
Yeah. Not yet. Anyways.
Not yet. Have you got? I got a couple more.
Go for it.
Anything else from your side?
No, not at the moment. I just threw up into the live chat some of the highlights of the 2001 European Grand Prix. Hopefully there's some good shots of the crowd there. I mean, it was pretty cool. I mean, if that's what it was like, when Schumacher was racing Ferrari, it just, I sort of salivate about that thinking, I got to go to Monza one day, you know, just as a neutral fan and sit there and just soak up the atmosphere and watch the Tifosi go nuts. I mean, that's why it would have been awesome to be there in 2019 when Charles won that race. You know, I know there's a bit of an asterisk beside that because of the dodginess that was going on with the Ferrari, allegedly, during that season. But I mean, the atmosphere there and the way that Charles held off those two Mercedes cars for the entire race, I mean, it was exciting, and the atmosphere was pretty cool. But anyways, over to you, my friend.
Yeah, so another great question here from BJ Miller, and this is something that I didn't plan to ask on air, but I thought it was a really good question. With AlphaTauri being the development team for Red Bull and the struggles AT drivers have had making the leap, blah, 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 why doesn't the team make the setup of the AlphaTauri cars, Scuderia AlphaTauri cars, identical to the Red Bull ones? And I think basically what he's asking here is like, hey, if AlphaTauri is supposed to be the development team, why have two different cars? Like, why bring them into Formula One and they have to learn one car, and then they make the transition over to Red Bull and they have to learn another car?
Fair.
I think early on when Red Bull entered the sport and they gobbled up a competitor team and turned it into what was at the time Toro Rosso, that was their intention because they could. In 2009, the technical and the sporting regulations were overhauled, and every single individual team had to develop its own chassis from the ground up. So for Red Bull to have a sister team using an identical car or even similar suspension setups, they have to run the same chassis, which isn't possible. So AlphaTauri, based on the technical and the sporting regulations, are required to build an independent car that is completely different than anything else being developed on the grid. So because they have to build their own chassis, they have to build aero packages that complement that chassis. Now, there are some sanctioned parts. So under the guidelines of the technical regulations, there are some parts you can buy, things like gearboxes and power units. And naturally, they buy those parts in unison with their kind of parent team, the Red Bull team. But ultimately, the technical regulations, the sporting regulations, just prohibit teams from sharing chassis. So a customer team cannot buy a chassis from another team. So even Haas, that borrows everything they possibly can from Ferrari, they outsource. And I think it's Dallara, but I think even Haas has a third-party company that's not Ferrari that develops their chassis for them. So in the case of AlphaTauri, it just comes down to whether Red Bull would like it or not, they can't have identical or even similar cars. Now, I think I think, again, like I said, that's probably something that they would have preferred, but ultimately that's not the way it played out. Now, currently that team, again, the AlphaTauri team is actually based out of an entirely different country. So Red Bull, like we've talked about so many times before, is based out of Milton Keynes in the UK. AlphaTauri is based out of continental Europe. They have complete and total creative license on their car, their aero, their chassis. They get a little bit of feedback from Red Bull in terms of gearbox and the power unit, and they get some technicians from Honda, but ultimately they're kind of just on their own, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, that's just the way it is. Yeah, great question.
Cool. All right, what else have you got, or should we take a break?
We can take a quick break, and then when we come back, we can either go back to the mailbag and Twitter, or we can actually go and maybe just talk about maybe a couple of the news stories that have been out in the last couple of days. Okay, let's do some news stories. Perfect. Okay, let's do so in a moment, so please don't go away. We'll be right back. Okay, well, welcome back to the show. And where should we start? Basically, the stories I wanted to cover tonight as we start to close it down here is I thought it was interesting because I think that you tweeted it and I think we mentioned it briefly in one of the recent shows was about George Russell, because one of their senior people in the team, Dave Robson, says that seeing George leave at the end of this year in 2022 would be a massive loss for Williams. And, I think that goes without saying, but I think the story or the things that that we'd previously addressed was, George basically coming out and saying that, he wants his, his F1 future decided by the summer break or by the end of the summer break and stuff like that. And as much as I love George and what he's done, so far and how he's grown as a driver and his, his very short and brief Formula One career, is that I don't think he's at that stage of his career that he can really make those statements. I think that that it's his prerogative to say so. And of course, he's going to want to have that clarity. I just don't think that, he's got anything that he can back those, those statements up with or those desires.
You're absolutely right. I'm not clear, and I said this on Twitter, I'm not clear what his leverage is here. Ultimately, he has designs on one seat, and it's not clear that that seat's going to be available in the offseason. Mm-hmm. And if not, where else are you going to go? I mean, quite frankly, there aren't a lot of really attractive seats that are going to be available next year. And if you did take a seat that wasn't Mercedes, you are basically putting the nail in the coffin that is your Mercedes career. And yeah, just to be clear, because I think a lot of our listeners have asked this question, he is a Mercedes driver. He was part of the Mercedes Academy. He is technically under contract to Mercedes until the end of this year. Now, he has a contract to race for Williams because he's effectively on loan to that team because Mercedes didn't have an opening for him 3 years ago. But ultimately, if he opts to not stay with Williams and there isn't an opportunity for him to drive with Mercedes and he goes somewhere else, his designs on becoming a Mercedes driver are over. But I'm not clear where it is he would go. And I get his frustrations that he feels that he's potentially being underutilized and his development is being stunted at that Grove-based Williams team, which has shown marginal improvements this year, maybe. Mm-hmm. I, to be fair, they're showing positive comps in their times at each of the tracks this year, which is good, but they were just so bad last year. Maybe it's irrelevant. I don't know what his leverage is. And it's not like he's coming out frequently in the media and stating this, because I think it's pretty clear that everyone at Brackley understands that's where he wants to be. And I think that's where the British press wants him to be. And he's a young driver. I just don't know what leverage he has.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, if Mercedes decide to go with Valtteri Bottas and Lewis and they want him to keep the seat warm at Williams, he'll probably do that. But I think if Williams or if Mercedes goes with somebody other than Valtteri Bottas, then I think his time is up anyways. But yeah, I get frustrated with these comments because I don't know what leverage he has.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I'm going to sort of try and bring this discussion back to this. You'll see where I'm going with this in just a moment. But Christian Horner, team principal at Red Bull, has said that Sergio Perez is ahead of expectation, but there are no rush to give the Mexican a new deal for 2022. Now, we've talked about this before with the whole rotating Kvyat, Albon, Gasly rotating door that they've had at that number two seat at Red Bull. I mean, throw Danny Ricciardo in there as well, although, his decision was self-induced, self-inflicted to leave the team rather than being, you know, forced out as with those other drivers. But the thing is that we've talked about it before. At some point, if they want to be serious in challenging Mercedes or Ferrari or whoever's the top dog, they need that 1-2 punch like they had with Danny Ricciardo and Max Verstappen a couple of years ago. And they just don't have that stability, right? Sergio is looking more and more like that guy. I mean, I know it was a bit shaky through the first couple of races of the season, but he's had a couple of good races underneath his belt. And I mean, I think Baku was his best weekend by far for Red Bull so far this year. But I mean, we still have you know, three quarters of the season basically left to run. So I can see what Horner is saying, where he's coming from, why that that they think he's ahead of the where he needs to be. But they also don't need to rush into giving him a new contract. Fair enough. But hey, Christian, you know, if it's just me and you, you know, friendly hint, you got to commit to, a solid second driver at some point. You're going to know who and when the circumstances are right. I'm sure you're much better to judge that than me, obviously. Now, this is interesting. I mean, we've seen these ties to Mercedes have been detrimental to some of these younger drivers in recent history. Esteban Ocon was, and I mean, to his unfortunate, result, I guess is the best way to put it, is that ultimately that tie-in with Mercedes ended up hampering him, and he had to spend a year out of Formula One after doing so very well at Force India. Of course, they had Mercedes power units, which they still do now as Aston Martin. But ultimately, at the end of the day, his hands were tied, and he had like this wonderful connection to Mercedes, which ultimately didn't lead into a drive with Mercedes themselves, and handcuffed him in the opportunities to go to other teams. And then instead of being able to race, he spent 1 year basically sitting on the pit wall in the garage as the reserve driver for Mercedes. Now, if it came to George Russell. You know, and I don't want to suggest that, Toto Wolff is a vindictive person or mean, but I think that his priorities are with the Mercedes, and he will always look out for Mercedes and the best interest of the team. Another young driver should mention, too, that had that connection was Pascal Wehrlein, not even Formula One, after being reserve driver for the team in the Hamilton-Rosberg era. Anyways, going back to George, I could see Toto, not wanting to sever those ties with George, even if it meant that he had to sit out a year, because say they didn't want to give Sergio Perez a new contract, and say George, had his eyes on that second seat. Well, I mean, why not? I would see that I could very much see a scenario with Mercedes and with Toto, not because he's trying to do the wrong thing by George, but by wanting to do the right thing by Mercedes, is not wanting this guy to go, knowing how good he is, to get him in, let him go to my direct and immediate rivals and get him in that second car, because, it didn't work out with us, but, put him in a competitive car, which has been better than our car at times, many times this year. And then that's going to hurt us. I think he's always going to put his Mercedes interest above anybody else's. That's just the way he rolls. Dude, you got to unmute yourself.
Thank you for that. It feels like every Zoom meeting I've ever been at.
There you go.
It's funny because I only just realized I can mute myself because I tend to sit in a squeaky chair. So I've really useful tool to have. But thank you for that. But it was flashback to every meeting I've ever been at in the last 15 months.
Yep.
I think the thing that kind of came to my mind as you were talking then is, and we talk about this so much, is Red Bull's in this unique situation because they own a separate team. And even though that team functions largely independently of the parent team, they control the drivers, right? So if I'm Red Bull and I have an academy and I'm developing drivers and I have two seats at my alpha team, my core team, if I've got more talent and I want to keep them and I don't want to lose them to another team, I can stash them away at Scuderia AlphaTauri. If I'm Mercedes, as much as I want to lean on Williams to be that for us, they're still a totally independent team that isn't receiving cash from Mercedes in any mm-hmm. meaningful way to help support their operations. So ultimately, they'll take George Russell because he's young and because he's cheap. But ultimately, they're not going to be, they're not going to allow the Brackley squad, they're not going to allow Mercedes to dictate who their drivers were. But you're right, because Mercedes has developed some young talent over the last couple of years. And you look at Esteban Ocon, that's a great point. After he lost his seat at Force India, which is another team that was always kind of speculated or linked to be a potential Mercedes B team. After he lost his seat there, he was out for a year. And I know he traveled with Mercedes and he did some sim driving and some test driving, but that's not what he wants to be doing. And then your other point too about Wöhrlein is Wöhrlein did ultimately lost his seat. They didn't have anywhere to stash him. Mm-hmm. I think he ended up doing DTM driving in Germany. And once you're out of Formula One for a year or two, it's really difficult to come back again, especially with the influx of young talent. So that's definitely a struggle Mercedes has had, is that when it has developed young talent, it doesn't necessarily have anywhere to put it, especially when you have somebody like Lewis Hamilton on that team. And he's just kind of going to unquestionably have a seat every year that he possibly wants one. And then again, it just comes down to Bottas and how much pressure this puts on Bottas. Because when you went into the 2017 season, they had some young talent. Russell was still a couple years away. Ocon wasn't ready. Wöhrlein definitely wasn't ready. They didn't have anyone from the academy ready to go. So they went with Bottas, and he's done what they needed him to do the last couple of years. But now you're in this position where you have Russell, and what do you do with him? Ultimately, he doesn't have any leverage. There aren't really going to be any opportunities anyways, but you risk losing him. And if you think he's a valuable asset, you've got to make a move to accommodate him, or he maybe does go to a different team.
Yeah. Well, if you look at Wöhrlein, just to kind of bring this story to a full circle, I mean, he's now racing in Formula E for Porsche. So there you go. And I mean, he's completely about as far away from Mercedes as you can get. I mean, although Porsche is obviously another German car manufacturer.
That was that super funny story I shared before, by the way, when I met Wöhrlein. Thought it was Ocon. And all those years, I thought I'd met Ocon until I saw Ocon on the screen one day. I'm like, oh, they've mislabeled it. They're saying that's Ocon. I'm like, oh, no, I met the wrong guy.
There you go. Moving along. Okay. Well, that's hilarious. I seem to remember you actually told me that story before. I'd forgotten about that. As we start to just to kind of round it up for another show, Mark, I guess this should not be any surprise, but as we go into the French Grand Prix this weekend, Red Bull said they're braced, they're completely prepared, and they have no doubt that Mercedes is they're going to come at them with everything, including the kitchen sink this weekend in France. I mean, they've had it's probably the two worst races in their history since 2014. I mean, they've had bad weekends here and there, but I mean, they've struggled in Baku, they struggled in Monaco. And there's been a lot of questions asked of them over the past several weeks, and rightly so. I mean, when you sit at the top as the best for so long, and you have a couple of races where you're so much off the pace, and compared to your rival, that I think it's just right and proper that that these questions are asked. So I mean, it's stand up and be counted for Mercedes this weekend. I mean, Red Bull, they have to be prepared, but I mean, at the same time, they just need to focus on what they need to do. They need to go out there and just go out at Paul Ricard and just focus on their own weekend, and ultimately whatever Mercedes does, they do, and then they'll just have to deal with it on the track on Saturday and Sunday.
Red Bull's not stupid, right?
No.
If you look at Christian Horner, if you look at the World Drivers' Championship standings right now, you look at Lewis's performance. He won. He had a second-place finish. He finished first. He had a really disappointing Monaco, and I don't think either of us would argue otherwise. That was a disappointing result. Azerbaijan, he finished 15th. He had the opportunity to win that race or at least take a podium. He made a driver error. I don't think that's a reflection of the car or the setup of the team. That was a driver error, and he owned it. And if you look at Bottas, he scored a podium in Bahrain. He had a retirement in Italy, but ultimately that wasn't his fault. I still am strongly of the mind that that was a George Russell issue, where George Russell collected him and took him into the wall and ended his race.
Yeah.
He finished third in Portugal. He finished third in Spain. He retired in Monaco. Again, regardless of what Toto Wolff said about the finish, the fact they didn't he didn't land on his marks when he came into the box, I don't attribute any of that DNF to him. And then he had a really poor Azerbaijan, and part of that could have been set up, part of that could have been pace, whatever. They've still had some good results, and I think if I'm Red Bull, I look at this a different way. Like, you know what? He could have podiumed in Italy. He could have had a podium in Monaco. He had a bad race in Azerbaijan. Lewis had a bad race in Monaco. He had a good race in Azerbaijan, except for one error. Really, they're in a position where if things had broken a little bit differently, both of their drivers would have scored a podium in every race but one each. Like, the results could be a little bit different. So I think they're being conservative because they know that the results could change very quickly. That said, and I don't want to be criticized for being a Red Bull homer because I'm definitely not a Red Bull fan, but they just seem to have everything clicking right now. Mm-hmm. There's suspension set up. Their aero seems to be dialed in. The bendy wing, whether it's illegal or not, is certainly helping. Everything just seems to be clicking. The chemistry between the two drivers seems to be great. And yep. You know, Sergio had said it before the season that it was probably going to take him 5 races to get comfortable with the car. You know, 5 races into the season, he'd already had 4 top 5 finishes. And then in his 6th race, he wins a Grand Prix. So I feel like things are clicking for them. But what will make this race exciting on Sunday isn't the track. It's going to be the dynamic between the 4 drivers and the 2 teams in the championships.
Yeah, you know, just to finally finish off this whole thought here, that Toto Wolff also just said in the past couple of days that despite the struggles that they had in Monaco and in Azerbaijan, that this does not alter their plans for the development of the 2022 car. I mean, they're focused on that. And I mean, why would they? I mean, that is the ultimate goal. I mean, this is this weird kind of in-between season that was kind of forced upon us because of the pandemic and everything like that, and the way that they basically carried over the cars from 2019 into 2020 and now into 21 with some subtle changes here and there. But I mean, the cars are by and large the same that they've been for the past couple of years. And I mean, this next year is going to be completely different. I mean, why would you take your focus off this completely new generation of cars that we've seen to basically sink, you know, your resources and time and money into a car that's only going to be used for another 15 races or whatever it is said that we have left in the season? I mean, it's obviously going to be concerning. It's going to be frustrating. I mean, it kind of comes back to where we started at the top of the show here, just talking about the fact that they don't have the DAS system installed on the car this year, which is obviously having a bit of a detrimental effect on what Mercedes is able to do. But yeah, I mean, 2 bad weekends. Why would you disrupt the bigger picture just to, throw people and time and money at this current car?
Yeah, cool. That's all I got on that.
That's all you got on that?
Wrap this up here shortly.
Sure.
But I wanted to make sure I gave a shout out to Mr. Vincenzo Landino. He set up a Twitter Spaces chat on Friday afternoon. I was late because I didn't correct for the 3-hour time difference, but it's another great chat. So we'd hosted one just as a test last week, a Twitter Spaces chat. It was fantastic. The chat that Vincenzo hosted and moderated was probably even better. Well, it was much, much better. And we'll continue to try to do those kind of things to involve the community. But the one thing I would say, and I know you kind of commented this offline, is that the fear is always that the audience gets smarter than us. And we're already beyond that point, my friend. We're beyond that
point of no return. But it's awesome. I mean, especially to hear from fans old and new, and especially the new fans that are coming in, just how quickly people are picking things up. It's really, really cool to see. And most importantly, that the one thing that's really, really cool to hear from people that are either brand new fans or existing fans or fans that have come back, that everybody seems to enjoy it. And the one cool thing is that we see around here is like the continuing and growing sense of community, which is a lot of fun. I mean, it's like we say, quite often that the whole reason we do what we do here is because we love it and we love to talk about Formula One, and we like to connect with other Formula One fans to talk about it. And it's cool. It's awesome. I'm looking forward to doing it again, not just tonight, but Thursday and Sunday night, and then Monday, Tuesday, next Thursday. A lot of shows coming up, let's just put it that way. But I'm not complaining. We love what we do, and it's a lot of fun. And on that note, on behalf of myself and my friend and co-host, Mr. Mark Hamilton, thank you guys for checking in, albeit on the Twitter live stream. I mean, what's wrong with me? With the YouTube live stream or via the podcast. Thank you all, one and all, for downloading and listening or watching on YouTube. Take care. We'll be back in a couple of days. And until then, thank God Monday's behind us. That's all I got to say. And on that note, take care. Talk again soon. Bye for now.